The 70s fads, part two. We're still on clothes, but then we'll start looking at some other fads. Now, several fashion statements were inspired by movies. Diane Keaton's crazily lovable character in the 1977 Woody Allen movie Annie Hall spawned an anti-style in which its oversized men's shirts, long skirts, cottage shoes, and baggy khakis allowed women to be at once funkily chic and safely conservative. John Travolta's energetic portrayal of Italian stallion Tony Manero in Saturday Night Fever introduced a generation of young men to the passing fad of the three-piece white suit. The attire was almost mandatory at certain night spots and all senior proms. Western wear was already popular when the movie Urban Cowboy premiered, but the film created an unprecedented demand for the Wild West apparel, which included shoestring ties, fancy hats with feather bands, glittery silk shirts with mother-of-pearl buttons, and especially high-priced ostrich, python, and lizard-skin boots. By late 1981, reported the New York Times, quote, the Western apparel created a $5 billion industry, end of quote, though the galloping success of the fad would wane the next year. The most gung-ho designer of Western paraphernalia, Ralph Lauren, would make it his signature look. Polyester leisure suits. First, a bit of background. The men's three-piece wool suit, oriented in Europe in the 18th century, not as a business wear, but as a more leisurely country horseback riding attire. Appropriately, the cut was loose, bordering on baggy, and the coat, vest, trousers ensemble was called a lounge suit. The jacket's back slit accommodated the horse's back, and the lapel hole was intended not for a carnation, but so that on a cold day a man could turn up his collar and button it snugly. Gentlemen found lounge suits so comfortable, they began wearing them in the city as well, and a business tradition was born. The early 70s after-hours leisure suit, a fashion nadir, was something of a return to the lounge suit worn not by country gentlemen, but by that swinging singles predator, the lounge lizard. Hardy wools, Harris tweeds, and earth-tone colors, staples of the traditional suit, were replaced by indestructible polyester, welting pattern weaves, and an array of pastel colors that would make the Easter Bunny blush. As the 18th century lounge suit was designed to be a casual alternative to a tailored business and formal wear, so too was the leisure suit, often without lapels, given boxy hip pockets, and cut along the lines of a loosely belted tunic, all features to emphasize its recreational intent. To maximize profit, it was promoted as an acceptable office attire. The leisure suit was not new in the 70s. It had been favored for more than a decade by golfers on courses in Miami and Palm Springs, but now it was priced down and promoted to what the groovy single wore to relax or prowl. It never did catch on as an executive's office attire. Favored by sports figures and entertainers, by the end of the decade, a leisure suit in one's closet was an embarrassment, evidence of being, or having been, a lounge lizard. Elegant restaurants like New York's Lutace posted signs, no leisure suits. As hot pants were bequeathed to prostitutes, leisure suits, upon the fad's demise, went to pimps. Now for some fads. In the summer of 1978, to the surprise of Hollywood executives, National Lampoon's Animal House had moviegoers standing in long lines to view the grossly humorous shenanigans of the Saturday Night Live's John Belushi and his fellow boys of Delta House at fictional Farber College. The beer-swilling, bar-fling, underachieving Delta boys were unsavory as role models, but their obscenely funny antics, inspired by National Lampoon founder Doug Kenny and contributor Chris Miller, created a fall campus fad reminiscent of early crazes like goldfish swallowing and phone booth packing. The blockbuster movie, set in the early 60s, contained a brief wild toga party, called a Greek party in the 60s, in which fraternity boys, donning bed sheets and laurel wreaths, danced lasciviously while drinking themselves into oblivion. 1 month after the nation's colleges had resumed fall classes, Newsweek reported that more than 100 campuses were hosting weekend toga parties. 10,000 partying undergraduates at the University of Wisconsin attempted to get their toga party into the Guinness Book of World Records by creating and consuming the world's largest mixed drink, a vat of sundry bring-your-own-booze. Why did the Greek toga party amass such a devoted following in the late 70s? Sociologists agree that after the 60s radicalism, American college students had grown more conservative, their campus pranks more measured in zaniness and irresponsibility. In a nutshell, they were bored, and thus primed for the kind of good old red-blooded American mischievousness depicted in Animal House, explained one observer at the height of the winter of 1978 Togomania. Unfortunately, showings of the unreservedly rowdy movie around the country left a wake of student vandalism. Numerous campuses reported an increase in incidents of cafeteria food fights, and pranks played on teachers and administrators and costly damage to school property. All highlights of the film. Belushi's egging cry of "toga, toga, toga" became a much feared call to prankishness on campuses around the country. From the folks at Universal, the studio that made the film, Togomania meant more money in the bank. Produced for a meager $2.7 million and promoted with a $4.5 million budget, the film took in more than $50 million in its first 2 months. National Lampoon magazine's cut of the gross for the period was $3 million. Unexpected beneficiaries of the Togomania were the nation's department stores, which reported sheet sales at an all-time high. Indeed, in cities like New York and L.A., it was vogue for young adults to attend the movie clad in togas. Whereas the movie's popularity continued to grow, catapulting it to a cult classic, Togomania did not survive the academic year. Mood rings. In the Mead decade, the mood ring was the quintessential amulet to sum up the era's quest for instant knowledge and self-mastery. The ring's stone consisted of a heat-sensitive liquid crystal that changed colors to reflect the bearer's shifting moods. Purple, bliss; blue, tranquility; yellow, green, stability; if not dullness, reddish-brown, irritability; black, gloom, depression, and despair, if not worse. During a few months in 1975, more than 20 million mood rings were sold, cheap rip-offs costing as little as $2, with the real things designed by creator Joshua Reynolds selling at Bontwit Teller and Neiman Marcus for up to $250. Celebrities like Barbara Streisand, Ali McGraw, and Muhammad Ali spoke glowingly of their chameleon-like rings, faithful reflections of their moods, and syndicated columnist Eugenia Shepherd gushed approvingly over the invention as a much-needed thermometer of the mind. To fully grasp the mood ring mania, it is necessary to realize that the trinket appeared at the height of another craze. Biofeedback is the science of monitoring hidden body rhythms and feeding back that information to more favorably alter those rhythms. Newspapers and magazines ran articles on employing biofeedback sensors to achieve creative alpha brain states and deeply meditative theta brain states. Attempting to capitalize on the trend was the 33-year-old Joshua Reynolds, alleged to be the descendant of the 18th-century British portrait painter Reynolds, and the heir to the R.J. Reynolds tobacco fortune. After having little success establishing biofeedback seminars, which used cumbersome EEG machinery, Reynolds conceived the idea of a portable biofeedback aid. With the help of a New York press agent and with financial backing from an actress-turned-perfume executive, Polly Bergen, Reynolds kicked off one of the two biggest fads of 1975, with the other being the pet rock. The ring, an instant hit, was not without its flaws. First, it responded crudely to temperature, a variable haphazardly correlated with specific emotional states. A desired color could easily be achieved by minimal cheating. Merely holding the ring tightly could turn it tranquil blue. Over time, the liquid crystals wore out, the ring growing progressively blacker and blacker. Many companies offered lifetime guarantees, convinced that the fad would fade before the ring blackened and needed to be replaced. And they were right. By 1976, the market for the mood rings was flooded with cheap plastic imitations, as well as spin-off items like color-changing mood shoes, belts, watches, and panties. Unfortunately, Joshua Reynolds did not move fast enough in securing a patent and profited little from his invention. His meditation center in New York, Qtran, Tran for Tranquility, plunged into the chaotic state of bankruptcy. Had he been wearing one of his rings, its color would have been predictable. As far as toga parties, when I was on campus, which is 70 through 74, we didn't have any toga parties. That was obviously a little bit later. However, when I taught high school, the seniors would periodically do that at homecoming or at senior day in the spring. They weren't supposed to do that, but eventually it became a regular event for 4 or 5 years until the kids got tired of it, and then it disappeared. Sources: Pinati's Parade of Fads, Follies, and Manias, The Origins of Our Most Cherished Obsessions by Charles Pinati. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, sumahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.